This is Blaise Bonpane with the second segment of World Focus. It seems to me that anyone who is thinking can recognize a cheap shot when they hear one. For example, if one is called anti-American if they oppose the policies of George Bush, being pro-American is solely a matter of wanting what is best for the people of the United States. It has no relationship to approval or disapproval of the person in the presidency, especially when that individual is not even elected. The same logic applies to other countries as well. If one is called anti-Semitic for opposing the policies of Ariel Sharon, we can see an equally cheap shot. This analysis, anyone not supporting the Likud party would be called anti-Semitic. This kind of name-calling is both irrational and exceedingly harmful. It actually attempts to make an idol out of the person in power. Millions of Jews in and out of Israel are completely turned off by the behavior of Mr. Sharon and his party. Are they anti-Semites? Israel has a vibrant peace movement. Are its members anti-Semites? One thing is certain: hatred of Jews or hatred of Arabs is surely anti-Semitic. Nation and religion continue to be contrivances for warmongers. Wouldn't it be excellent if we could understand that our religion is very much a matter of geography, that it represents a local cultural effort to acknowledge the Almighty, and that those local cultural norms become solidified into ritual form? Once we do this, we can join together in mutual respect. I'm very privileged today to have Stephen F. Rohde as my guest. Stephen Rohde is a constitutional lawyer, a lecturer, and a writer. He's the immediate past president of the ACLU of Southern California. He's the co-author of Foundation of Freedom, published by the Constitutional Rights Foundation, and he has written numerous articles and books on civil liberties and constitutional history. He's the author of a new book, American Words of Freedom, which explores the origins, history, and meaning of the Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Constitution, and the Bill of Rights. And most recently, he wrote Liberty and Truth Are the First Casualties of War for Verdict magazine. We're very happy to have you with us, Steve. Thanks so much for being here.
Blaise, it is my privilege to be on your show. You have been one of my heroes in the movement for justice and peace from the first time we vigiled together years ago against the death penalty.
Oh, I remember that so well. And now we're confronted with new and frightening laws that, Steve, it seems to me that this plethora of laws were written before 9/11, and that worries me. About the Patriot Act was certainly written, if not promulgated, before 9/11. Is that the way you see it?
I do. I think people have to understand that in the wake of 9/11, within weeks, legislation, later called, so cynically named, the USA Patriot Act, 362 pages of detailed legislation, which amounts to an unprecedented assault on our Fourth Amendment, First Amendment, and other constitutional rights. I have said that I'm convinced much of this bill was in the left-hand drawer of John Ashcroft before 9/11. We know this because similar anti-terrorism and death penalty legislation was passed in the wake of the hysteria surrounding the Oklahoma bombing, and it was legislation that had been written before that attack.
You know, what surprises me, Steve, is that it was never legal to bomb a federal building or to attack the Twin Towers. Why was all this legislation necessary? These things were absolutely against the law. We had all the structures necessary to deal with them. Why the new stuff?
Blaze, in both instances, it is not necessary. These are expanded powers that the government has gathered unto itself through this legislation, like the USA Patriot Act. Governments want power. They want expanded power. Surely this administration does. They have exploited the fear and the hysteria of the American people. They began by exploiting the fear and hysteria of Congress and the Senate by jamming the USA Patriot Act through. It was eventually passed on October 26th. The day after, many legislators called the ACLU and said, "What did we just sign?"
They weren't even familiar with it.
They didn't know it. No one could digest. There were no public hearings. There was none of the give and take that democracy demands. And we are now beginning to see the outgrowth of that sweeping legislation and other unprecedented steps that this administration has taken as an assault on civil liberties.
Steve, what is the motivation for a legislator in signing something that he or she is not really familiar with? How can they do that?
The only way I can explain that is there then and now was such fear of being labeled disloyal, unpatriotic, a traitor. Language like that was thrown around during the months after September 11, and these legislators showed no backbone. I've said repeatedly that when the profiles in courage of this era are written, in the Senate, one man stood up and voted against the USA Patriot Act, Senator Russ Feingold, Democrat of Wisconsin, and 66 members of the House of Representatives voted against it. Their vote now, in retrospect, was the clearest and truest patriotic vote because it was a vote that upheld the principles of this country. We cannot defend freedom by destroying freedom. And unfortunately, that's what's happening.
Well, I worry very much about the rhetoric coming from Washington because I teach logic and I teach all of the different fallacies that there are in speech. And one of them is called bifurcation. And when I heard the president say, "You are either with us or with the terrorists," I immediately recognized that particular fallacy, which means there are two possibilities and only two, and it absolutely is untrue. There are 2,570 possibilities. I'm not with you. I'm not with the terrorists. I have a different idea. So to confine people to this or that in that fashion is a classic fallacy, which goes together with a warmongering. And I've heard so many such fallacies coming from the administration. Now, in this legislation, we've been followed the Patriot Act, and we've had more after that. We had the particular act about Leave No Child Behind, which included the right to get the names, addresses, and phone numbers of every student in our high schools for being actually recruited. This is against the scholastic policy of the United States. I don't know if you've followed that particular adventure of the Leave No Child Behind Act.
Yes. I mean, it's terrifying in its manipulation. I mean, to have legislation that sounds so benign, something that anyone would want to embrace, leave no child behind, when in fact it is a major invasion of privacy of our children by having school principals provide the names and addresses and phone numbers of male students for potential military service. And I hope your listeners, as we catalog these erosions, begin to think about the prospect of a draft, that this is a war that will impact families and young people, that there are many in the military today who never signed on for preemptive war against another nation. I think those members of the armed services are now serving under false pretenses and should have a right to withdraw from an unconstitutional war. And that's not what they bargained for. It's not what the American people bargained for. But the cynicism of the language used by the government is breathtaking. The other example we need to get on the record early on was John Ashcroft saying that critics of the administration were aiding the terrorists and giving aid to our enemies. This is shameful for the highest law enforcement officer of our nation to lie to the American people that at times of crisis, dissent and disagreement is somehow disloyal.
This is Blaise Bonpain. I'm speaking today with Stephen Rohde, who's a senior partner of the law firm Rohde & Victoroff, and also has been president of the Southern California ACLU. Steve, we have in the Los Angeles Unified School District the JROTC, and throughout the country we have some 500,000 students who are getting this military training. Now, what I discovered in investigating this was that the Los Angeles Unified School District pays for this. They don't get it even for free. And so at a time when they're cutting the budget of credentialed teachers, they're bringing in non-credentialed people to teach the students to aim, shoot, and kill at a time when we're trying to keep guns out of the schools. And I'm just wondering, where's the logic in this?
Yeah, there's no logic. What I want to see is peace and justice training,
yes,
paid for by the school district to allow people like you and me and so many others to have access to high school students. I spoke at a satellite magnet school yesterday and spoke in terms as clearly as I am today on this show, pointing out that 16, 17, 18-year-olds are going to bear the burden of this war and this endless war that the president speaks of. We are, if there's an access of evil and if there are 60 countries identified by the president as targets, this is indefinite. And young people today are going to grow up into a culture that will attempt either because of their own economic circumstances. You know, military service for a lot of people of color and poor children from white families and elsewhere see military service as an avenue to education and to training, but they never expected to see it as an avenue to preemptive war against countries all over this globe.
I have a military former officer in my class who the other day said that he had 73 men under him, and he had checked with all of them how much education they received. He said three of them received some education in the service. He said that was it. Now, what makes me happy, actually, is that in speaking in the schools and in observing the conduct being on the streets with demonstrations, that there is a great deal of support for the position of the peace movement at this time. And I've noticed this since 9/11. I mean, the Coalition for World Peace started right after 9/11, and then this magnificent group, the Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace, started shortly after that. I have not been surprised by the opposition, but I have been very touched by the support that we have received over the years. I wonder if you have any thoughts on that.
I'm having exactly the same experiences. I'm, you know, speaking frequently every week since 9/11. The audiences are filled with young people. They are curious. They are eager for information. ICUJP has been having vigils every Saturday at the corner of 3rd and Fairfax from 6 in the evening till 7:30. We've had a tremendous turnout of young people, people simply coming up to that corner, joining us, picking up a sign, handing out bumper stickers, and then more broadly at events, at teach-ins, at workshops. I think what that means, what that says, is that the message of peace and justice is clear, that it goes immediately to the aspirations of young people, that there's no complication, and that even the drumbeat of war on CNN and Fox News, constant graphics and expectation of war, still does not succeed in brainwashing and manipulating everyone.
I'm really excited about that, and we're planning a very large demonstration January 11th, starting at Olympic and Broadway, and this is going to include so many of these groups that have come together to work on peace. And an exciting thing happened yesterday. The acting president of the United States, Martin Sheehan, agreed to be a speaker at that demonstration. I think it's most admirable for him and the other artists who have come out against this war and who have risked a great deal in doing so. And they are out there and making a very clear message. They actually are the only royalty we have in the United States. We don't have a regular royalty, but our celebrities seem to make up some type of royalty. So we're very happy that they'll be out there, and that it's been good to see the interfaith communities United for Justice and Peace getting together with other groups like ANSWER and Not in Our Name and the Coalition for World Peace to work together on planning and developing these demonstrations. We hope that will continue in the future, and we'll see how well we can work together and coalesce coalitions.
Yes.
That's our...
Well, this, if I have a moment,
sure.
This movement is growing. This peace and justice movement is growing at leaps and bounds. I am so impressed. We heard from Tom Hayden last week at a conference that this peace movement is farther, deeper, broader, stronger at this respective time in this war than the peace movement in the 60s against the Vietnam War, which is where I cut my radical teeth. And I think it's because people are getting the message. They are informing themselves over the Internet. They're getting past the media monopoly. And they are understanding the threat both abroad and at home. We haven't mentioned, but I'll take a moment to mention the Homeland Security Act,
yes,
which had within it, and people just have to understand this and study it on their own, the Total Information Awareness System, by which the Department of Defense will engage in what's called data mining of personal information on every citizen and non-citizen in the United States, our credit card purchases, our hospital records, our educational records. You know, anyone can check the story on this, because to hear me describe it, you'd have to think I just finished reading George Orwell.
Indeed, and Admiral Poindexter's on top of this total information system.
Admiral Poindexter, convicted of lying to Congress. His conviction was reversed, but not because of the underlying events he engaged in. This is a sweeping invasion of privacy. And what I've thought about is where we've started years ago with a country in which it was the government that was open and the people enjoyed their privacy. We have now distorted that So government acts in secret, and people have no privacy.
We've had a complete reversal of the really principle behind our country, that the people should have privacy and the government should be a fishbowl.
Exactly.
And now we've turned it around the other way. Now, on this Homeland Security, we also seem to be trashing the union structure of some 400,000 people who work for government.
Yes.
That's another component here that was just included. I mean, people fought and died for the rights of unions and for the right to organize and have collective bargaining, and now we're seeing it just destroyed from the top.
And we also, in that act, had the Freedom of Information Act restricted.
Yes.
We had whistleblower protection removed. Mm-hmm. This government is getting, because of the weakness of the opposition party, this government is getting anything it asks for. And until a massive demonstration of public resistance shows itself, we cannot depend on the opposition party, and unfortunately we cannot depend eventually on the United States Supreme Court. We may win some victories, and we have won victories in lower courts. There's a wonderful opinion out of Cincinnati opening immigration hearings that were closed by fiat of the chief judge of the immigration courts last October, a year ago. That court opened immigration hearings, and in a phrase that I hope will resonate, a judge wrote, "Democracies die behind closed doors."
That's exactly what worries us, and that's why it's important for us to reflect on what Mr. Nixon said in his memoirs, that when he saw 500,000 people in the streets of Washington, he realized the war was over. And I think that we're going to have that same presentation for our current incumbent resident in the White House, that we're going to, on January 18th, attempt to have another 500,000 people in Washington and a similar demonstration in San Francisco. The day after that, there will be a formation of a Congress, a People's Congress, which will get many, many signatures to insist that we get back to peacemaking, that we get back to health care and schooling and the rights that we have as Americans, and that we get back, by the way, to the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, which have been, I think they've been trashed in recent moments. So it's so important for attorneys like you, Steve, to be on this as you are.
And well, this is a powerful, multi-level, multi-generational, multi-regional movement. Not everybody can make it to Washington or even San Francisco. There are activities in every community. There is the internet. There is the ability to contact elected officials, newspapers. Every time anyone that's listening to us sees a story in the newspaper about the assault on civil liberties and the war abroad, and they are outraged, they need to sit down, write a one-paragraph letter to the editor. They won't necessarily get their letter published, but I'm assured by editors that every letter that makes it in is in proportion to the letters on that topic that the newspapers get. So if you write a letter, yours may not see the light of day, but another letter with a similar viewpoint will, and that allows people to know that there are like-minded people out there. Far too often in our culture, with all our overabundance of communications, people can feel isolated, alone, and despairing over the very same evils and violations that you and I are talking about.
This is Blaise Bonpain. I'm speaking with Stephen Rohde, who's senior partner in the law firm of Rohde and Victoroff. I'm so excited, Steve, to see full-page ads coming out from Religious Origins. The Methodist Church just took a full-page ad out to remind Mr. Bush of his religion and his religious background and where he came from, and said that their religion that he belongs to does not support this kind of warmongering. And also to hear on the announcements on this station, 18 gatherings in the Los Angeles area in a week for peace all over this area. So at the moment of this great crisis, we also have a fantastic opportunity taking place for people at the base indicating that this is their country.
This is true. I've asked audiences to take the $1 one-hour pledge. Is peace and justice worth 1 hour at least of a day to read, to study, to communicate, to organize, to demonstrate? I think peace is worth that, and I think peace is worth at least $1 a day if people chose an organization, the ones we've talked about, others, their local church, any organization that is struggling for peace and justice. That's 365 days at the end of the year. It means you can't supersize your McDonald's or maybe skip a pack of cigarettes here and there. But think of what it would mean if every person we're listening to who is yearning for justice and peace would devote at least $1 a day and 1 hour a day to that work.
I think that's an extremely important message, Steve, because some people simply look at the great icons. I mean, I'm a great admirer of Phil Berrigan and all those who have come before him in the most dramatic and heroic acts. And some of people may think, if I can't do that, then I can't work for peace. Well, that's exactly what Phil Berrigan and the others wouldn't want to say. They'd like to say, if you can stuff envelopes, if you can do something, if you can make a phone call, if you can talk to your family, that is also part and parcel of this movement. I think it's very important for you to mention what you just did about the fact that everyone can do something.
And I just heard today a wonderful phrase, resistance at the water cooler.
Yes.
You and I know a wonderful man, Father Chris Panette, leader of Pax Christi in St. Camillus.
Yes.
And he coined a phrase that resistance to war and injustice occurs at many levels. And for some people, it may be the act when you're standing at the water cooler, which is a metaphor for any conversation you have in your workplace, or I would dare say with your family over your holiday dinner or wherever you are, and someone speaks in terms of bombing the hell out of Iraq or putting people in jail, or what's wrong with racially profiling Muslims and Arabs at airports. Resistance is looking that person in the face and respectfully saying, I think that's wrong.
Steve, we fully support that, and Father Chris Panette is actually right. I don't know what happened to the time. I want to thank Sarah El-Tantwani, Director of the Communications for the Muslim Public Affairs Council, and also Stephen Rohde, who is senior partner at the law firm of Rohde and Victoroff. And I want to thank my engineer, Nathan Thompson, and my producer, Lisa Smithline. For a transcript of this program, you can call 323-852-9808, 323-852-9808. Thanks a million, Steve, and I hope to see you soon.
Thank you.
Blaise Bonpaine.
Salve Regina, Mater Misericordiae, Vita Dulcedo, et Spes Nostra Salve. Ad te clamamus, exules filii Heve, ad te suspiramus, gementes et flentes, in hac lacrimarum vale. Ea ergo, advocata nostra, illos tuos, misericordes oculos, ad nos converte. Et Jesus.